It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. What's your compulsion? That thing you can't stop doing could be something ordinary, like checking your phone every 5 minutes. Or it could be something more unusual.
So Shala Nicely has classic OCD.
Science writer Sharon Begley.
She became convinced, for no obvious reason, that her cat Fred was in the refrigerator. So she opened the refrigerator once, and no, there was no cat inside. But then her brain got this itch. What if Fred was actually behind the gallon container of milk? Maybe I just didn't see him. She opened it again. Still no Fred. She would go away. She would tell herself, no, he's not there. And then the thought would come back. And then she thought, well, maybe, you know, he has quantum teleported into the fridge when my back was turned. So she opened the refrigerator again. This is a very intelligent woman, but it consumed the better part of a day for her.
Shala managed to get over that particular compulsion, but some of the more classic OCD symptoms can be a lot harder to get rid of. Needing to wash and rewash your hands dozens of times a day. Checking and rechecking. Did you lock the door?
Did you lock the door?
Did you turn the lights off?
Did you check the lights?
Or at the more extreme end, hoarding or compulsive shopping. But the thing is, we all share this tendency. And in her new book, science journalist Sharon Begley argues that compulsions are not eccentric quirks limited to obsessive germaphobes or reclusive hoarders, but things many of us do every day without even realizing it.
Right. And that's really one of the messages that I really hope readers take away from the book, that just because you have a compulsion, just because you engage in a compulsive behavior, does not mean that your brain is broken. It could instead, and in many cases does mean, that you have found a way to alleviate anxiety. One of the things that was so difficult as I was beginning the research and reporting for the book was just pinning down experts to explain what a compulsion is. Compulsions are driven by anxiety. There's either a little tickle in your brain or a deep, deep fear that something is about to go wrong or has gone wrong. And the compulsion is the way that you get rid of that anxiety.
Was there for you a single moment or experience that made you want to write this book and made you think about how some of this compulsive behavior isn't just extreme, but is stuff that you see, we all see around us every day?
Yes, and it was indeed those everyday observations. As you know, I work in a newsroom, and for as long as smartphones have been around, and before that, Blackberries, no reporter can go anywhere without one of those devices because your editor is always trying to find you, or a source finally gets back to you exactly at the moment when you have to go to the ladies' room. So I would look around at my colleagues and myself and think, you know, they're carrying these phones, but none of us seem very happy about it. And that's the difference between an addictive behavior and a compulsive one. If you're addicted to whatever, roller coasters or whatever, they actually make you happy. You like it in some sense. It gives you pleasure. But when you are compulsively carrying around your smartphone and having to check for texts or tweets or Facebook posts or whatever it happens to be all the time, in so many cases, it's not because of pleasure. It's because of anxiety, the fear that you are going to miss something. Mm. So, you know, this is a very, very common behavior. And it was indeed the sort of instigation for me to do this book, asking how many of the behaviors that we do over and over and over again that we can't seem to resist doing are in fact because we need to drain away what would otherwise be intolerable anxiety, as opposed to because they make us happy, they give us pleasure.
So when I'm on a bus or standing at the bus stop, and there are all those people tapping away at their phones all around me, they're not necessarily looking for distraction or pleasure even. They're anxious?
In many cases, absolutely. And the reason is that the structure, as it's called, the reward structure of texts or emails or a tweet, whatever you're looking for on your phone, is what psychiatrists describe as intermittent and variable, which simply means they're like a slot machine. In a slot machine, you could get orange, lemon, cherry, pull after pull after pull, and you never win. And then suddenly you get, you know, jackpot. So it's completely unpredictable. Same with, let's do texts. You can get one after another after another. And every once in a while, there actually is one that's important. And the other, you are really glad that you didn't miss even for, you know, 2 seconds. So it's that uncertainty that tethers us to the phone. The other thing that's going on here is that more and more of us just simply cannot stand to be alone with our thoughts. And I'll give you just one sort of amazing experiment that pointed this out. Researchers took away the smartphones of a bunch of volunteers, and the volunteers were told, you can either just, you know, sit and stare into space and, you know, think about whatever problems you're having or think about what you're going to be doing tonight, you know, whatever. Or you can give yourself an electric shock. And almost half the people could not stand to just do the daydream introspection thing, and they preferred to give themselves electric shocks.
You're kidding.
People
would rather give themselves an electric shock just
rather
than just sit there alone?
That wasn't everybody. It was about half. But still, that's an awful lot of people who just needed the external stimulus of an electric shock rather than just sitting and thinking. Mm-hmm. So something, a similar psychology is going on when we just can't stop looking at our screens.
Well, I know anxiety is on the rise. I think actually your book quotes a bunch of different studies, but it's just recently turned out to be the most diagnosed mental illness on college campuses now. So does that mean that we're living in a country with rising levels of compulsive behavior? Are we all becoming compulsive?
Right. But I think it's just incontrovertible that there are just way more sources of anxiety today than at least, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And whether it's, you know, anxiety over environmental harms or the next terrorist attack, or maybe a somewhat less fraught example, but even something as seemingly inconsequential as online shopping used to be. You would go to a store, there was a limited supply, you would have a sense of what the entire supply was, you would make your choice, hand them your credit card, and off you go.
And then came Zappos.
Yes, and then came Zappos, where the number of pages is in the hundreds. So again,
right,
you know, maybe you're on page 2 and you really like that pair of boots, but something in your brain says, what about page 712? So it's not a surprise that many of us are feeling anxiety. And like the woman who keeps her house controlled and in order to a T, we feel that we have to do one thing in our life to keep it under control, to give us a sense that we have agency, that we have some effect and control on the world. And for many people, it's a compulsive behavior.
Well, this raises such an interesting question about how we label things, how we decide what's pathological and what's normal and what's not. I mean, you point out, for instance, that as a culture, we treat various compulsions differently. So something like hoarding, we ridicule. Something like, say, compulsive exercising or workaholism is admired. So why is that?
Right. So when I describe these behaviors as existing along a continuum on a spectrum, the obvious question is, okay, where at those extremes do you cross from, you know, sort of eccentric or quirky into this is pathological, this is a mental illness? And the best I could come up with was to defer to the official psychiatric explanation, which is this. If a behavior causes distress or impairment, then if it meets other criteria for being extreme, then it is a mental disorder. So in the case of a hoarder, the impairment obviously is that the building inspector will come and condemn your home. If it's keeping your house really, really neat, there is a condition called obsessive compulsive personality disorder, which is short of OCD. And OCPD can manifest as extreme conscientiousness, neatness, etc. But if you're just doing those things and it's not causing you distress, it is not impairing you, it's doing the opposite, then it is not an illness, it is not pathological, it is coping.
Mm. You know, one of the things I'm wondering, listening to you, is throughout the course of the 20th century, we've kind of increasingly pathologized different kinds of behaviors that used to be seen as, you know, not necessarily so terrible. So I'm wondering, do you think the compulsions we see have just always been around and now we're just starting to label them as such? Or if you look back in history, I don't know, has compulsive behavior waxed and waned or changed over time?
Well, certainly society's view of it has. And in the past, you know, official psychiatry has not covered itself with glory. It has pathologized, it has medicalized things that are really, you know, I'm sorry, just part of the human condition. And they have learned a lesson from that. So they are pulling back in many cases, not across the board, but at least in some, and recognizing that, for instance, to qualify for a diagnosis of obsessive compulsive personality disorder, OCPD, you have to meet so many criteria. I include a questionnaire in the book. And, you know, if you compulsively put the bath mat just so, and you compulsively do this and you compulsively do that, you still don't qualify. I mean, you really have to do a lot of these things a lot of the time in order to meet the diagnostic threshold. So, yes, that is absolutely a recognition that humans come in all sorts of varieties. Some of them are a little quirkier. And, you know, we don't want to be in the position that psychiatry was 150 years ago when it called slaves' propensity to escape a mental illness. So that is not a good thing.
Well, we've talked about compulsive behavior as a kind of coping mechanism at the less pathological end. Would you go so far as to say there are good things about compulsive behavior?
There certainly are for society in people who feel compelled to donate a kidney to a stranger. So I have a chapter on good compulsions, and that ranges from people who felt compelled to create art to writers, but probably my favorites were the kidney donors. So when I came across people who donate a kidney to a stranger, I really, really pressed them to ask why they did it. What did they feel, you know, in the months or more leading up to their decision? How did they feel at the moment? And not for everyone, but for a substantial number of them, they described anxiety, knowing that there are people on the transplant waiting list who have to undergo dialysis and who in many cases die before they get the transplant or who can't tolerate the dialysis. That made them literally anxious. They could not just sit still. They could not stand by knowing that there were people out there in the world suffering whom they could help. And they felt compelled to donate a kidney. So, you know, that's a very specific and stark example of, thank goodness there are people who feel compulsions.
Sharon Begley is the author of Can't Just Stop, An Investigation of Compulsions. What's it like to live with OCD? To have things that you wish you could stop doing but somehow can't? Well, meet my colleague, Doug Gordon.
Hi. My name's Doug, and I have OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. Wait. Can I do that again? I stumbled a bit. Okay, never mind. I check things over and over again. For example, I make sure that the burners on the stove are all turned off, even if I never turn them on. When I park the car, I make sure that I turn the car headlights off. Sometimes, I'll even go right in front of the car, bend down, and stare directly into the headlights, just a few inches away. What if someone sees me? Don't worry, I got that covered. Oh, hey, didn't see ya. Yeah, I'm just checking out the plastic covers on my headlights. Looks like there's a small crack in this one, doesn't there? I guess I better get that fixed. Okay, have a good one. Do I wash my hands over and over again? Check. Do I sometimes wash them again a few minutes later for no good reason? Double check. Do I make sure the sliding glass door is locked before I go to bed? Yes, and so on. Repeat when necessary. Repeat when necessary. When necessary. Necessary. Sorry. Repeat. Wait. Repeat. Necessary. Necessary. And so. And so. Sorry. Why? And when my OCD is at its worst, the compulsions are always necessary. Let's do that again. Why do I do it? It would be easy to say it has something to do with the fact that my dad was 50 years old when I was born. But blaming 50-year-old Scottish spermatozoa is too easy.
That's right, Laddie. You best not be blaming your OCD on us.
Take some personal responsibility for once in your miserable life. We're not gonna be your scapegoat.
So why do I continue to do these irrational rituals? The obvious answer is that it's a compulsion.
Brilliant observation, Einstein.
Shut up, inner critic. It also has to do with the way that my brain's wired, or should I say miswired. But I can't afford to hire a neuroelectrician. Do you know how much they charge? On a subconscious level, it probably has to do with control. We live in a world in which we have very little control over our lives. By washing my hands over and over and making sure that the clock radio alarm is set for AM and not PM, it's my small way of sticking it to the universe. I'm saying that I do have a small bit of control, some little bit of agency to smack down my angst for at least a little while. Now, if you'll excuse me, I think I left the kitchen tap running.
Doug Gordon. He's my colleague and a producer on To the Best of Our Knowledge. And coming up, what Steve Jobs, Estee Lauder, and baseball legend Ted Williams had in common. How compulsions drove some of the greatest innovators in American history. Next. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio. NPRX. I'm Anne Strange-Jampson. We're talking about compulsions this hour.
The sensation is analogous to being held at gunpoint. You have to do whatever it takes to make that feeling go away. So you do.
Ethan Smith has had OCD as long as he can remember. When he was little, he says it manifested in pretty traditional ways.
I had what's called magical thinking. So I was afraid, let's say, if I didn't tap my toothbrush two times in each hand, a train would crash in Europe, or people would die, or something bad would happen to people that I love. I actually had one where I had to stare at a girl's boobs for 13 seconds without getting caught. And it would always come up like when I was in synagogue. And if I didn't make it to 13, I'd have to do it again. But I also had to not get caught. In retrospect, that might not have been OCD at all. That just had been becoming a man.
But as Ethan got older, his OCD got worse. In high school, he became an extreme hypochondriac, terrified of getting sick. He carried a thermometer with him at all times. He took his temperature 60, 70 times a day. He went through years of therapy. He was hospitalized, at one point misdiagnosed as psychotic, before he and his parents finally found a treatment that worked, thanks in part to the OCD Institute, or OCDI, in Boston.
So the right treatment for OCD is what's called CBT-ERP. The ERP is called exposure response prevention. What it is the person that has OCD is exposed to their greatest fear. You start very, very small, and you slowly work up to your biggest fears. Through a series of events, my OCD had shifted from fear of illness to I was afraid I was going to hit my head and cause a bleed, like a brain bleed. I would wrap my hands in the elastic of my underwear to protect myself. And so the first ERP I did was I went to this clinic and they explained to me what they'd be doing. So I sat down and he hands me a piece of paper and a pencil, and he says, I want you to number the paper from 1 to 100. So I did. And I was like, what are we going to do with this? He's like, I want you to hit your head on 100 objects around the office. And I was like, excuse me? I would go up to each object and, like, It would take me at least 5 minutes to get my head close enough to touch it. I would touch it with maybe the force of a feather. And then toward the end, another therapist there came out of the office, heard what I was doing, and says, "Oh, well, let me help." And she takes a fire extinguisher off of the wall and hits me in the head with it. Like, up to that point, I was fine because I wasn't hitting my head hard enough to hurt myself. But in my mind, she had literally just killed me. It was January 2nd, 2011. It was the day after New Year's. I wish you could see the pictures. I was really just a shell at this point. My hair overgrown. I'd lost 100 pounds. I looked like I had stage 4 cancer from a mental illness. It was absolutely insane. And I went to go see my psychologist. We were doing a new exposure, which was to hit my head as hard as I could. And I refused to do it. It sounded crazy. You could really hurt yourself, like legitimately hurt yourself. And he said, "Well, if you don't want to get well, then I'm just calling security." So I did. And he was really excited. He was like, "Awesome job. Now I want you to go into town and go get a haircut." The reason he told me that was because the whole idea is to feel the anxiety and to keep living. So I went into the city, which was like a half mile walk down from the campus. There was tons of snow on the ground, ice, slippery, freezing. And I was sitting in the chair getting a haircut, and I just couldn't stop thinking about the bleed in my brain that he'd caused and that I really was going to die this time. And I got so freaked out that I was convinced that I was going to die and needed to get to a hospital. Well, the only problem with that was I'd signed a contract with my therapist and my parents that I would be cut off completely, considered dead to them and every other miserable thing if I'd gone to a hospital. And that was their way of preventing me from getting my head checked out. Of note, so like somebody would wash their hands because they feel dirty, I was getting CAT scans because I thought something was wrong with my head. I mean, that's how severe it was. So that's why the contract was in place, to keep me from going to hospitals. But then I thought to myself, well, you know, what if I could get the hospital to come to me? So I decided to stage an accident. And I walked about a half mile down from the barber shop, and I ducked behind an apartment building, and I found like a jagged rock. So I cut my head open, and then I walked a little ways and turned a corner and went to a not-so-busy street, and when no one was there, I literally just fell face-first into a snowbank. And I laid there for 25 minutes until a passerby walked up to me and shaked me. "Hey, buddy, you okay?" So they took me to the hospital. I got a CAT scan. I was fine. And I went back to the OCD that night about 9 o'clock. And first of all, I had this relief in me, like literally like I just shot up heroin. But I also felt like I hadn't done anything wrong. Like I saved my life in my head. I went into the office of my therapist, and there was a phone sitting on the table, and we were having a conference call between my therapist and my parents. And they said, "Well, your parents have sold everything you own to help pay for therapy, and you're going to stay in Boston and create a new life. In exchange for that, you can continue to get outpatient treatment and have your life. Good luck." Just to get the other side of perspective, it was described to my parents as, "Your son has a 50% chance he can make this work, or he may kill himself. But you're out of options." Ultimately, my parents decided to give me a shot at getting better. The next day, I got kicked out. So I found what was pretty much a crack house on the south side of Boston on Craigslist for $400 a month. And it was terrifying. People were doing drugs in the house. It was absolutely terrifying. And I went up to my room and I closed the door and I put my dresser up against the door and I got into bed and I laid there for 6 days. And I didn't move. I was consumed with fear and anxiety and OCD thoughts, and I felt abandoned. I couldn't believe that my parents and doctors had given up on me. About 6 days later, got to the point where I was probably going to die just because I wasn't taking care of myself and I wasn't eating and I wasn't drinking and I wasn't doing anything. I was going to the bathroom in the bed. And that's when I had the epiphany. I realized that nobody was coming to save me. It had to be me. I had to do it. I remember standing up out of bed. You gotta go to the grocery store and get food. Oh my God, what if I slip on the ice and hit my head, and I got all nervous and sweating, and I was about to get back in bed, and I was like, no. No, you have to risk it. And that was sort of the beginning of the eventual journey out of hell. Slowly but surely, you know, I started getting better, and I moved to a house where they just did drugs. They didn't sell them. It was much better. And, you know, I started having a life. And literally at the end of August, I went in for therapy, and I said, can I leave now? Like, can I go to L.A. and follow my dreams and do what I've been wanting to do since I was born? And they were like, yeah. I was always sort of OCD slave. I always worked for OCD since I was born. So when I got better, people were like, we're so glad you got your life back. I'm like, no, I was reborn. Like 100%. I did not get my life back. I didn't have a life compared to what I have now. OCD does not play a role in my life today. Like, if I check in with my thoughts right now, I have zero OCD thoughts. They're really just whispers, and I ignore them very, very quickly because for me, my bottom was so low that it's just like, you know what? All of the options that I'm afraid of are way better than the life I just came from.
Ethan Smith is a writer, director, and producer who lives in Los Angeles. Think about the qualities that drive great American innovators. What comes to mind? They've got to be tenacious, independent, ambitious, and you know what? It doesn't hurt to be a little obsessive. In his book, America's Obsessives, journalist Joshua Kendall profiles seven iconic American innovators, from Steve Jobs to Estee Lauder to the baseball legend Ted Williams. He tells Steve Paulson these all-American superachievers had one crucial thing in common. They were compulsive.
And these were individuals who all had these obsessions and compulsions, but in their case, it led to staggering success. So rather than being a liability, the obsessions and compulsions were an asset, and it enabled them to jumpstart their careers and to continue to function at an extremely high level throughout their professional lives.
And it would seem because they were all perfectionists in some way. I mean, the negative spin would be they were control freaks, but they wanted to get everything exactly right.
And that took a toll on their personal lives. Most of them were very unhappily married or didn't have good relationships with their kids. But in their professional lives, it put them, in Ted Williams's case, it put him in the Hall of Fame.
Ted Williams, who was obsessed with how he swung the bat.
Right. He was obsessed with his swing. He was so obsessed with hitting a baseball that his pickup line to women was, show me your swing. And he thought that was a way of connecting. And he would literally carry the bat with him all over the place. His bat.
Wait, are you serious? Like, he'd go out to a restaurant, he'd carry his bat with him?
Not quite that extreme, but when he was a manager of the Senators, he would be holding a bat at all times. And he had this hitter on the Senators. This is in the late 60s, after he's retired from the Red Sox. And he tells the Senators' worst hitter, carry a bat with you wherever you go. And Brinkman has the best year of his career and hits about 280. So he tried to sort of steep his players in his own obsessions, and it often worked.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, let's talk about some of the other people that you write about. Henry Heinz, founder of the iconic ketchup company. What was his compulsion?
He loved measuring things, and he carried a tape measure wherever he went. And in the middle of a meeting, he might just start, you know, measuring the door or something. He took it, pretty far. I mean, he goes to Germany, back to his native country with his family one summer, and he keeps a diary. And in his diary, he's obsessed with the measurements of the ship. And it's something that he can't stop thinking about. And I guess other obsessives, one of the other obsessives is Melville Dewey of the Dewey Decimal System. And the Dewey Decimal System, you know, organizes knowledge through the number 10. It's a decimal system. It really was the kind of Google of its age. But for Dewey, decimals weren't just a way of organizing information. They were a way of living. He used to say that he liked to sleep decimally. He liked to get...
What does that mean, to sleep decimally?
10 hours a night. he just felt most comfortable with 10 hours a night. And then Dewey, in his 50s, starts Lake Placid, which is a resort for very, very nervous teachers in upstate New York. And everything there is organized decimally. You know, it has a 10 p.m. curfew, and there's a train that leaves from Lake Placid at 10 p.m. And again, tens were kind of in his blood. But the amazing thing is that we know Dewey today because that obsession led to this innovation. And it was, again, the Google of its age, and it was instrumental in organizing knowledge at the turn of the 20th century.
But there's often a dark side to these obsessions. So in the case of Dewey, he also had kind of these sexual obsessions, didn't he?
Yes. Obsessions often go with sexual compulsivity. And Dewey, to put it mildly, couldn't keep his hands off the librarians. Today, we're kind of used to sexual harassment, and we see it a lot. But in those days, it was kind of in the closet. So any cases that we read about from the early 1900s must have been very extreme to get noticed and for the women to be believed. And Dewey was kicked out of the American Library Association.
Wow. I mean, he's the guy who basically revolutionized libraries, yeah. And he got kicked out of their trade group.
Yeah, and he had to retire at the age of 50 because over a 10-day trip, he grabbed four different women, and they all complained. This was in about 1905.
Wow. Now, there's another innovator you write about, first woman we're talking about, cosmetics pioneer Estée Lauder, whose luxury brand was built really because of her nose. She had this incredibly fine sense of smell. And she came from rather humble background, didn't she?
Yes, most of them, the obsessives, came from kind of hardscrabble Dickensian childhoods, and that's often where the obsessions start. In Estée Lauder's case, her mother is a Jewish immigrant from Hungary. She just knew Yiddish. And then her mother has six children, and then the father leaves. And so Estée's mother has six children and no husband in this strange country. And then she meets another European Jew, and she marries him. So problem solved. There's only one knot, which is that now she's worried that husband number two is going to leave her because he's 10 years younger. And when Estée is about 3 or 4 years old, her mother begins every day with an elaborate beauty ritual. Her father goes out to work, and her mother is scared that husband number two is going to leave. So she starts combing her hair, putting on makeup, and just trying to be beautiful. And Estée, as a little girl, age three, is helping her mother every day.
Talk about a founding myth for someone who's going to found a beauty empire, a cosmetics empire. I mean, you know, getting it from your mother.
Well, not only doing it to your mother, and that's what she did for the rest of her life every single day. She couldn't stop putting makeup on women because for her, making her mother beautiful sort of kept her family intact, and she couldn't stop doing it. I interviewed her granddaughter. She grew up in New York in the 70s, and Estée used to accompany her to PTA meetings at her private school. So as soon as she meets the teacher, she gives the teacher a makeover.
Wait. You have to explain. She reaches out. She touches the teacher's face?
Oh, yes. Yes. She can't stop touching face. She'd do makeovers on people in elevators, in trains. I mean, she cannot stop touching faces.
Hmm. So in all of these cases, you're saying there was adversity in childhood that really created these compulsions. They weren't necessarily born with them. I mean, there was something that was happening in their childhood, and they were kind of nervous wrecks, and this was their compensation.
Yes, it was a kind of survival mechanism. People don't know this about Ted Williams, but his mother was very poor, and she wasn't around much when he was a kid. She wanted to save all San Diego's drunks, and she would be riding the buses at all hours of the night. He described her once as a Salvation Army nut. He was very isolated. And what he would do to calm himself down was swing the bat. And that's how he sort of bonded with his bat. The bat became kind of his attachment figure. You know, again, I talked about his blanket. I mean, the bat became his connection to the world.
What I find amazing about the story is that just by swinging the bat over and over again, you know, probably watching yourself in the mirror do it, that you could actually become a great baseball player that way. Somehow I wouldn't think that that kind of practice would actually turn into greatness.
And that's what's so interesting is how, because compulsions, again, are things that they can't stop doing, but that, you know, in his case, he just kept on swinging. Or in Estee Lauder's case, she just kept on putting makeup on people, and you just do it again and again and again. And it led to some kind of major innovation and kind of shaping our culture.
And yet, when we talk about these kind of obsessive personality traits, I mean, these are disorders. As far as I know,
yes,
they are still classified as pathologies in the DSM, aren't they?
Yeah. So there's a lot of confusion about the diagnostic nomenclature. The main confusion is between obsessive compulsive disorder, which is very disabling, and I argue that these individuals had obsessive compulsive personality disorder, which is disabling when it comes to human relationships, but not necessarily when it comes to your profession. Now, obsessive compulsive disorder are people who have a hard time functioning, and they have thoughts that are scary, so maybe they'll think that their hands are dirty, and they'll just keep washing their hands until they cut the skin. I mean, they might spend 10 hours a day washing their hands. They're just convinced that they're affected with germs. So those aren't people who are going to start Apple like Steve Jobs or write the Declaration of Independence like Thomas Jefferson, whom I profile, or build a billion-dollar business like Estee Lauder. People with obsessive compulsive disorder are impaired from functioning. But people with obsessive compulsive personality disorder, so these are people who love rules and order and perfection, those folks can function at a very, very high level. They almost function better than well because they have all the sort of extra juice.
So it sounds like what you're saying is we need a more nuanced understanding of compulsive, obsessive people, that it's not quite as blanketly negative as we tend to think. You're saying that, I mean, to some degree, these people have made the world, or at least made America.
Yes, yes. That they can be extremely influential, and in their careers, they can really stand out. And just that our society is just so competitive, and it's been that way since the founding era, that people who are perfectionists and, you know, a lot of them are just totally preoccupied with work. Think about Steve Jobs, who basically revolutionized seven different industries, you know, and he dies in his mid-50s. I mean, just the imprint that he left was amazing. But they're kind of on hyperdrive. You know, you know those stories about a woman who sees her baby under a car and just all of a sudden lifts the car up.
Right.
It's as if these innovators have that kind of energy, you know, day in and day out for decades.
You mentioned Steve Jobs, and
I
guess we all know, we've all heard stories about how perfectionistic he was in his work at Apple. In what way was he obsessively compulsive?
Just about innovation and design. My book starts with a scene when he's building the first Macintosh computer, and the factory has to be absolutely spotless. He says it should be so spotless that you can eat off the floor. And he also was obsessed with design. When he's dying of cancer, he had tubes in his chest, and he literally rips them out, and he tells the doctor that he just can't stand the design. I mean, his claim to fame is designing these amazing products, and that's just something he couldn't stop thinking about.
Well, it's a great story. Thank you for coming in and talking about it.
My pleasure.
Joshua Kendall is the author of America's Obsessives, The Compulsive Energy That Built a Nation. He was talking with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio. PRX. Some time ago, we started a poetry project where we asked some of our favorite poets to experiment with writing new work based on the news. This is news defined very broadly as current events in our world or even in their own personal lives. Well, National Book Critics Circle Award winner Laura Kosciuszko wrote a poem about something that just happened, or almost happened, in her own life.
WTF. I see her just in time, a young woman. A girl, frankly, with her earbuds in. She's one of the many who hasn't bothered to look one way, let alone both ways, before stepping into the street today. I see her just in time to stomp the brakes in order not to kill her. She never knows what didn't hit her. She's wearing a t-shirt with WTF on it. Of course, I know what this stands for. I've texted it to friends. I've said it outright in public. Have whispered it, have thought it, written it, been at the center of what it means and what it is. But what I read instead, seeing her t-shirt's three letters through my windshield this afternoon, is what's to fear? Because she hasn't bothered to fear today, it seems. Some other time I might have gotten angry, honked my horn, unrolled my window, and shouted something out about suicidal tendencies, childish stupidity. But today I say to her silently instead, may such times continue to slam their brakes for you as you continue on your way. Or at least may you look up just in time one day to say to yourself something simple like, I've made a regrettable but rectifiable mistake. While the motorcades pass through you without wounding you, the flashing sirens and lights, the patriotic parades, the hearses flapping their miniature flags, the whole vehicular physics of everything slipping through you, waving politely, as if nothing might be the answer to the question you're not asking, what's to fear? As if this could save someone so young and so carefree. I used to be you. So that you, too, might live long enough to be a driver in some distant future, slamming on the brakes, just in time to save some people who weren't paying much attention to the world around them because they didn't think they needed to, people like me and you.
Laura, thank you so much for coming into the studio. And, well, first of all, I'm glad you and the pedestrian are okay.
Yes, yes.
But in the poem, this girl is wearing a t-shirt with the phrase WTF, which mm-hmm. is also what you titled the poem.
And yes.
It's just such a common throwaway phrase, but somehow, just by putting it in the poem, you've made it so much more powerful or more significant. That was your intention?
Well, thank you. Yeah, honestly, it was one of those moments where it didn't completely compute when in this particular context with her so close to being run over by me and my seeing that t-shirt and those letters, I did come to the conclusion that WTF could also stand for what's to fear. You know, it seemed strangely carefree for someone who had almost just died, you know, and didn't know it.
So, right.
Or almost ended up in the hospital, at least. I don't know if I would have killed her. I wasn't going that fast, but it could have been bad.
Well, I might be projecting this into the poem because I know that you often like working with fairy tale elements, that those are things that you've drawn on in the past. And so there's a way in which this girl, for me, became not just an annoying college girl walking down a too busy street in Ann Arbor, Michigan. She became like Red Riding Hood walking blithely through the forest and not paying attention to the big wolf that was hiding behind the trees.
I like that. Yeah, I like her archetypal potential there. I'm just attracted to that kind of stuff. I find it particularly applicable, I think, to female experience.
Why is that particularly applicable to female experience?
I don't know. I mean, I certainly read fairy tales to my son, but I don't think they cast the same kind of spell on him as a little boy as they did on me as a little girl with witches and princesses and evil queens and stepmothers and just all the maternal stuff and the daughter stuff, you know?
Maybe those are some of the oldest stories that we read when we're really young in which girls and women have powerful roles to play.
Right. Or they have messages they're sending. I mean, think of Little Red Riding Hood, all the warnings that are contained for girls in that story. I mean, you don't go off the path. You don't go with the wolf. If you do, what you really are going to need is some man with an axe to chop open the wolf so you can get out again. There's a lot of, I don't know, I think it's got a lot to do with girlhood and has a lot of messages for girls in that story.
Well, I love in this poem that at the heart of it, it feels to me, is this adult woman looking at this young girl, you know, on the cusp of adulthood who's not paying attention. And my association as a mother of a 21-year-old daughter is how you both want your child to feel carefree and fearless, but you're also terrified for them.
I have a 21-year-old son. So, I mean, I think about that a lot. And also, oddly enough, I teach college now on the same college campus where I was once a young woman. So I see versions of myself. And because my son is 21 and that my students are in that same age range, I have very maternal feelings towards a lot of the students. So this is a time when I'm just much more aware of, you know, political, military, world events, terrorists, you know, potential catastrophes at every turn. And I'm just aware of that. And, you know, and as you just said, I mean, at the same time that I appreciate the talk and the activism and everything, what I really want is for people like my students and my son to be able to live comfortable lives.
Right.
I know that that's a first world attitude, but I have hope for them for that, that they can, you know, keep thinking WTF. What's to fear? And not have anything to fear.
And I think that's any parent anywhere's desire for their child, though, is, you know, may the terrible events of their time somehow pass over their child.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you also about the settings of your poems. You know, you write these poems that kind of take, in some ways, ordinary moments and settings, like this one. You know, it's a crosswalk. What's behind wanting to write poetry out of these everyday kind of settings?
Well, I only have so much to work with. I'm in a domestic situation in the Midwest where I live. You know, I've been a mom. I drive around a lot. I do live outside of Ann Arbor, sort of in a suburban setting, I guess. But I also, I guess I feel that it's fun or an interesting challenge to try to make things that are real ordinary have kind of mythical dimensions. But also, I just think that there's just inherently in everything, all the ordinary things that we do, there's all kinds of weirdnesses and, you know, life in general is pretty odd that, you know, when you really start to think about it. I often think about there's a writer who his name is Richard Grossinger, and he lives in California, and he writes kind of new agey books, but he also writes about astronomy and anthropology. And he was writing a book, I guess, about people who believe that they've been abducted by aliens. Mm-hmm. And so he went to in Hamtramck here in Michigan. He went to a meeting in the basement of a bank that he had read about in the newspaper or something, being called for people who had been abductees or believed that they had been abducted by aliens. So anyway, but I guess he got to the meeting and the person leading the meeting said that they were very honored. I mean, I guess there were a lot of people there. And the leader of the meeting said that they were very honored that they had a visitor from Saturn in the audience. And then he said that he looked around and suddenly everyone looked like a candidate. anybody could have been, any one of the people there could have been, you know, the alien among us, the, you know, space person. And sometimes I think that, you know, it's like look around at the bank or something, just realize how strange everything is.
So that's what I love about your poetry. You do that, and whether it's, you know, suddenly for a split second, you can see how weird and space alien-like everybody is, or, you know, that we could all just as well be characters in fairy tales. It's something about seeing the possibility for the mythic in ordinary everyday life.
Thank you. Well, there was a movement for a little while in England, I guess, in the 60s, a poet, Craig Rainey, who it was Martian poetry, and people were writing Martian poems. You can Wikipedia it. I showed it to my students recently, people writing poems about the world from the point of view of Martians.
What do Martians think about us or about the world?
Well, he has a really good poem. No, I'm sorry, I can't remember the title of it right now, but in which Martians are looking at people who are holding books in their hands, and the books are described as like magical birds that seem to be speaking to the people through their eyes. And then at night, they curl together in pairs and watch movies with their eyes closed, which is a way of suggesting dreaming from the point of view of a Martian who wouldn't know what a dream was, I guess. I guess Martians don't have dreams or something. So
you do make me want to spend at least 15 minutes in the next staff meeting imagining that everybody on our staff is a Martian.
Yes. Yeah. Or which there was only one. You have to look around and figure out which one it is.
So this was so much fun, Laura. Thank you so much for talking.
Thank you so much.
Laura Kaczynski has published 9 novels and 9 volumes of poems. Her most recent book is called The Infinitesimals. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tungekar produced this hour. He had help from Charles Monroe Kane, Mark Rickers, and Doug Gordon. Joe Hartke is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Anne Strange-Champs. Thanks for listening.